This is the Inno the Buzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 61 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses with an interest in innovation become even more innovative. In this episode, my guest is Diane Kinney, the owner of the Versatility Group and also co-author with Carrie Dills of the soon-to-be-released book Real World Freelancing, the No BS Survival Guide. This was a fascinating interview where we talked about a range of topics, from goal-focused solution engineering, as Diane called it, to value-adding and being a partner to your client, the great SEO myth, project management, and content generation. Diane also coined the phrase during the interview, no easy button, which I so love. So without further ado, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Diane Kinney. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really honored to have with me today on this episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast from Sarasota in Florida, Diane Kinney, who's the owner of the Versatility Group, a boutique web design company. I'm really looking forward to this interview. Carrie Dills suggested that we get you on the podcast, Diane, so a big shout out to Carrie while we're here, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, it's a privilege to have you on the InnovaBuzz podcast. Now, you've written a book with Carrie called Real World Freelancing, right? It's the No BS Survival Guide to starting your freelancing business, I guess. And that's going to launch soon, isn't it?
Yes. 6 to 8 weeks. We're in the final stages of finishing that up.
Excellent. Okay. So, and we'll link to the website for that in the show notes, of course, and I look forward to hearing a little bit more about that. So before we start talking about websites and the internet and freelancing and all that kind of stuff and innovation, let's find out a bit more about you as a person and your background. So when you were a young kid, what did you want to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be an artist.
As in painter or...?
Probably... I was very into making things. When I was in fifth grade, I had designed like a coordinated shoe collection, you know, in a sketchbook, you know, platforms and flats and sneakers, you know, all to the ultimate detail. And I was always really into things like that, but I was also, you know, what they refer to as a gifted child in, you know, the advanced courses and things. Yeah, and so there was kind of this dynamic with me growing up that, you know, art was kind of an indulgence and, you know, I needed to focus on, what was the phrase they always used, you know, maximizing your talents.
Okay, yeah. I remember going through some of that with our kids anyway. So did you realize that art wasn't really a future for you, or what prompted the change?
Well, I gradually, you know, had, I just was lucky enough, you know, to have natural gifts in academically. And so I was very strong academically, and I was really encouraged parentally and at school to pursue either pre-med, pre-engineering, something along those lines. So I actually entered college as pre-med. I didn't stay that way, though.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to decide it wasn't for you?
It took until about that second dissection in biology, and I was like, no way. This is not something that, you know, I mean, I can't even cut up dead things. I'm certainly not going to be, you know, cutting into live things. So that made one thing very clear, you know, that pre-med wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And I always... was just, it's very easy for me to be interested in everything. So, you know, you can kind of put something out there, and it can be more on the, you know, liberal arts side, writing, and I thoroughly enjoy that. And it can be, you know, more on the complex engineering and mathematics side, and I thoroughly enjoy that. So I did not have a clear, you know, beacon or calling. I think I had several different majors during my college career and ended up graduating with a degree in liberal arts, which is really the, you know, giant catch-all when you can't decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Okay. So you finally did, though, have an arts degree. So
I kind of did.
An artist.
Yes, exactly. And then I had always been, I worked a lot. Like, I, even as a little kid, like 11 years old, I had a paper route, and, you know, I was a prolific babysitter and had jobs through high school. So I had this idea already while I was in college that instead of, you know, working at fast food or another low-paying job, maybe I could get more of a part-time corporate job that would pay more. And that's what I did. And so I had a part-time data entry job in the insurance industry. And then that kind of led me to, I spent the first 10 or 12 years, I think, of my career in progressive roles in the insurance industry.
Okay, so is that when you discovered the internet then, with the data entry stuff?
Yeah, I started working in, you know, with computers before there was an internet, showing my age to the maximum, and had a strong affinity for that. We worked, did a lot of things on mainframe computers from a work standpoint, and you could do a lot of scripting. You know, you're really on your own in those days in terms of if you wanted any kind of efficiency or to do things creatively, you really needed to learn to do those things on your own. And so I did a lot of that, and it was really fun. Really making things happen was something that I enjoyed. You know, the concept of figuring out how to do something efficiently, you know, like a mail merge when you had to do it without a tool, with code, or how to create simple databases. I worked at an insurance company early in my career in the claims department, and the entire structure was managed by this giant black binder with white pages in, and my boss would take a bottle of white out and carefully white out the status, you know, of a claim, like new, and she would white that out, and then she would very carefully write in active. And then she'd go down to the next one and she'd white it out, and then she'd write pending. And I said, you know, there's a really cool way we could do this, and you wouldn't have to do that. And so those are the kind of things that always interested me as a recurring theme, was just, you know, could we innovate a little bit? Could we move forward? Could we make things more efficient? And that's really been the theme, I guess, that's crossed everything I've done career-wise. And of course, that got kind of larger and larger and started to move, you know, beyond the scope of whiteout sheets.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I won't tell you about my first computing experience, because that will really let out my age in a big way. But I do remember using a typewriter and whiteout to write reports. So, but yeah, the idea of moving a claim from, you know, received to active to pending, whatever other stages there are, and just thinking about using something like Trello and moving it across the columns.
Yeah, we've come a long way in a relatively short period of time.
That's right, yeah. So the versatility group that you head up, that's been going about 13 years, right?
I think we're probably closer to 17 or 18 at this point.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going off the website. So, yeah.
Yeah,
so
their website's probably a little out of date.
Okay, yeah. So is that, was that your first sort of foray into your own business?
It really was. I spent most of my career in the first part of my career moving up in the insurance industry from, you know, a part-time, you know, data entry to... I became the VP of operations for a large publicly traded insurance company, and then a VP of application development for that same insurance company. And those were very interesting and successful ventures. But an interesting thing happens in corporate jobs. The higher that you move in the organization, you know, and especially as you near the very top, the work becomes very abstract. So I had gotten to a point where I didn't necessarily work in a hands-on way. I spent most of my time doing budget forecasting, performance reviews, and personnel development, and these really much more abstract concepts, which is enjoyable for a while, but I had a strong desire to I really like to be hands-on to some degree. You know, I don't ever want to be so removed that I can't look at code and know what it does or really understand, you know, actively what's happening in the principles of design or user interface. I just like to do things. So that kind of coincided with the dot-com mania that was going on here in Silicon Valley. And I had a friend out there who said, you should come out here and do this with me. I was like, okay. why not, you know, just pick up sticks and go to California and be a dot-com consultant for a while. And so I was fortunate in that I was working with a company that was successfully sold to it was a women's financial network that was sold to a brokerage in New York. So it was one of the more successful you know, dot-com pathways. They didn't go bust. And so that was a really neat experience. And so that kind of convinced me that maybe I could... We didn't so much think of it as freelancing or necessarily owning your own business at that time. It was really more of a consulting role where companies would, you know, bring you in for your expertise to solve a particular problem that they were having. Maybe a development project was stalled or they didn't have the best project management practices. So I kind of started out that way as a consultant. And I had traveled pretty heavily and had a young daughter during this dot-com, the end of my corporate career, the dot-com, and still as a consultant. And so I was really kind of tired and wanted to see if I could make a go of staying a little bit more in one place and working in that model. And so that's really, you know, was the beginning of the versatility group and the idea that I had an unusual background with my corporate experience and could I, you know, apply that to website projects and marketing initiatives, maybe on a slightly more modest scale than, you know, working with household name companies. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's an interesting journey. It sort of reminds me a little bit of my own journey. But I listened to a podcast that you did a little while ago, and it was interesting because I thought I need to ask you about this. So you've written a book with Carrie called Real World Freelancing, but on this podcast, and you've just prompted that now because you're talking about being a consultant, you said, I don't like the word freelancing. Really, we should be more consultants. And also you went on to talk about adding more value to a client when you're doing web design.
Absolutely. I do not care for the word freelancing at all, unless that's what you really intend. I think freelancing has a very specific meaning, and I think if we're honest about it, the history of the word, you know, is someone who does not have a relationship. You're a freelancer, so you're gonna come
free
in
to do what you want,
right? Yeah. You're gonna look at a very specific thing in a very defined way. You know, here's a piece of code that needs to be written or a function that needs to be accomplished, and then you're gonna leave, which is a model. But I don't think it's the model that most people who call themselves freelancers aspire to. They really are talking about building a business and a reputation and adding value. And there's also a lot of conversation, you know, about race to the bottom and pricing, friction and positioning yourself is part of that issue. You know, if you self-identify as a freelancer, you know, just a hired gun who's going to be coming on, you know, that doesn't open the door for conversations about how you can be a strategic partner to a client, or, you know, just the word consultant and the word freelancer have different implied meanings to people. So we went ahead and named our book Freelancing because it was a considered decision, because that's the word people use. But part of my mission is to help move them away from that word what they want to do is something more sustainable and more value-oriented.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting. I'd look forward to reading the book now. So a couple of other things you said on that particular podcast, I thought they were really... good advice, and I'd certainly like to explore that some more in terms of being that partner to the client and being a consultant. So rather than just building a website for them, the website might be at the core of, let's say it's a digital marketing kind of focus, then the website's at the core of that. But, you know, and you probably might tell us a little bit more about how you work at the Versatility Group and what you do, but my recollection was you're talking about immersing yourself in the business of the client, really understanding it, and then really it being more a strategic consulting project as opposed to build a website or
absolutely
grow my mailing list or whatever it might be.
I think every project, no matter, every project that I get involved in, there's the initial conversation is around goals. And the project could be fairly specific and defined. You know, I've done a lot of diverse things, like signage, a complete interpretive signage plan for a botanical garden, for example. Nothing digital, nothing, you know.
Okay, yeah.
So I think of these projects as, you know, what's the goal? So every project has a goal, and I think it's, or multiple goals. And a website, for example, is a solution. You know, a brochure is a solution. All the email marketing is a solution. But before you get to a solution, you should have goals and you should have an understanding of what I think of as a problem, and not a problem in a negative sense, but, you know, what are we trying to change? What are we trying to shift? You know, are we trying to grow awareness? Are we trying to, you know, sell something? Are we trying to improve communication or an experience? So it's been really great for me in terms of, you know, a career path to be able to work in all of these different areas of what I consider marketing, that in print media, digital media, you know, signage, experiences, different things, because I feel like they all, for me at least, have common threads. You know, we're trying to identify some type of path, and then we want to move down that path. You know, whether that's growing revenues or maybe it's reducing expenses. You don't hear this talked about much, but a huge opportunity for businesses is efficiency and reduction of expenses. Yeah. So, you know, if your online tools, for example, can help with that, which in many businesses they can, or we've done projects where we've made stronger integrations between the website and the internal processes that you don't see. So, you know, data's coming in and it's going, you know, into internal systems that are doing pre-quoting and pre-estimating and doing, you know, work that was done manually, letting staff and resources focus more perhaps on sales or on closing, you know, than a lot of administrative and clerical work. So that's the space that I enjoy, where we're, you know, moving a needle in some way, and getting a measurable result. And it almost doesn't matter, you know, what vertical that's in or, you know, what form it takes. It's really solution kind of engineering that I enjoy.
Yeah, I love that. I like the term too, solution engineering, because what I like to do is get the client into the mindset of what's the end goal look like? Let's start with the end in mind. So what's it going to be when it's done? And then work backwards. So which is essentially what you're talking about there, and looking at what's the solution to the problem, or what's the success picture going to look like, and then then we figure out the strategy and the tools to get there. And also, you know, I like what you said, that it's essentially a process. There's so many commonalities, so it can be applied across the board. It doesn't matter what vertical.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting process to watch, of course, because I can remember when there was no internet. Right? And so then we went through the first phase, where there were these newfangled things called websites, and nobody really knew why they needed one.
But they needed one. They wanted one.
They needed one.
Yeah.
Everybody has one, so I need one. So then everybody got a website, right? Pretty much. You know, there was definitely a point in time where, you know, this business shifted from, you know, mostly building new websites to now that's pretty uncommon unless it's a new business or a new venture. But most established businesses, you know, have some online presence. So it changed the conversation from, you know, let me talk to you about this new idea of online, to how do we make your online presence effective? And I think that's still the topic now. I don't think most people have really, there's a lot of shift, but I don't think the concept of like goal-driven design or conversion, you know, pathing and things like that are necessarily well understood by business, which makes sense because that's not their primary business. But I think we, as, you know, consultants and professionals, can play a big role in helping frame those conversations. You know, when a visitor comes to your website, you know, what potential outcomes do you want to see happen? When you think about those outcomes, what are the steps? Let's break that down into steps. Like, what kind of steps do you see making that happen? How can you put together content and pathways to make that happen perhaps more effectively than just doing the exact same website that everybody else has.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, it's interesting because you said earlier that years back everybody just wanted a website and they weren't even sure what it was going to do for them. I remember when I first started my business and I had happened to have really bad timing because it was at the time when the global financial crisis hit and a lot of businesses were really cutting back on their spend. And so I was trying to pitch based on my corporate experience, consultancy around a lot of the things you've been talking about. And usually I would get the response, we're putting those sort of initiatives on hold right now. We're cutting back our costs, got to see if we can ride out this crisis and so on. And then they'd always add at the end of that, they'd say, but we don't have a website yet. Do you think you could do a website? And that was before I'd done some websites, but that wasn't what I intended to do in the business. And then suddenly I realized that people were cutting back on costs on all the things that were probably important and going to have an impact on them. But this thing called a website that they didn't understand, they didn't know what it was going to do for their business. They were quite prepared to spend money on that.
Exactly.
So I thought, all right, well, I'll build you a website. And that was my entree into doing all the things that I really wanted to do for them, and which was, around delivering them more clients as the final end result. And so that's what the website
exactly
became.
And that's been my experience as well. The website seems to act as a bit of a even in large organizations where you have disparate departments and differing budgets and initiatives kind of conflict from a strategic standpoint, they still will come together. Not necessarily easily, but they still will come together, around their visible public presence. So it is a great tool to focus on. A lot of times you think it would be halfway or further down strategic planning, but starting with that, okay, we can, as long as we're starting somewhere. And we can work backwards, we can work forwards from there, we can look at integrations, we can look at, lead generation, as long as we start somewhere. So that's been my experience as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I also heard you talking, it may have been on the same podcast, about SEO. And you are certainly debunking that myth. And I think I wrote an article or a blog post, probably must be going back 3 or 4 years now, and I just got so frustrated one day about everybody, I'm not on page one, I'm not number one on Google, I want to be number, can't you do something? And so I wrote this article and I said, well, you've got to do something and there's no magic bullet and here's what you do. You've got to have a website and you've got to be talking to the right audience. And it's fascinating to me because even today I still get those requests or I get somebody come to me and say, oh, I've just hit number one on Google. And my response is usually, well, congratulations. Does it make any difference or does it get you any business? I'll get 20 or so emails a week saying, well, we found your website, we really like your website, but we noticed you're not number one on Google. And I said, well, I am actually, for the keyword I'm ranking for and for my target audience. What were you looking at?
I know. It's just, it's the most frustrating, set of beliefs, right? You have this cycle that's perpetuated, by these, I think of them as predatory businesses, right?
Yeah.
It's, give us a couple $100 a month and we're going to make you number one on Google. And it's like, it's the most ridiculous, premise. It's impossible. It makes no sense, but yet people buy into this over and over again. And there is some movement in some conversations I have, there's a greater understanding the beginning of it, but there is still that number one on Google, you know, here's a list of words I want to be number one on Google for. Well, this is a problem from so many directions. Yeah. So you want to be number one on Google for these words, and then what next? Hmm. What next? So a person types that word, theoretically, into a search engine. Hopefully, if you're a local business, which in many cases there is localization, that they're actually proximate to you, you know, and they land on this page about maybe, let's say, your IT services that you offer, you know, networking and phone systems, you know, so it's kind of a regional thing. So what happens next? The entire thought process with that whole thing stops with, you know, I want to be number one on Google. And I'm not even sure sometimes if they think about what happens, you know, that the person's going to bring up a page on their website. It's just, I want to be number one on Google. You know, it's like, and so what is your plan after that? Do you want them to join your mailing list? Do you want them to request a proposal? Do you want them to read more about your company? You know, do you want them to review the services that you offer? And I always start to go down this, you know, conversational path. And, you know, I often get kind of that open mouth response, like, I'm supposed to choose or figure. Yes, you are. Yeah. You are supposed to make a plan.
I tell this story, and it dawned on me when this happened to me. It was a few years ago, that this is a great metaphor. You know, I was buying some jeans and went into one of these big department stores and had a look around, found a pair that I liked, went and tried them on. They fitted beautifully, so I thought, that's good. And then I came back out and thought, I'll buy those. And there was nobody around in the store.
Right.
And there were no signs to indicate where the cash registers were. I couldn't see anything, you know, where you buy them or anything. And in the end, I just gave up in frustration, put the jeans back on the shelf and walked back out. So I tell people that story and I say, that's what happens with 80% or probably 90% of websites. You know, people find them. They're looking for something, they get there, and then they want to do something on that website, but they can't work out how to do it. It's not made easy for them, so they leave and they go somewhere else.
Exactly.
And so if you think about, okay, I was number one on Google, so somebody found my little my department store and went in and tried the jeans on, but then they left because I didn't make it easy for them to buy them.
And that, even one of the things that I think is so powerful for people to do is the single biggest flaw is you're so close in to your own business, you lose complete perspective, right? You believe that you have this deep knowledge, like let's say it's an e-commerce store. You have a deep knowledge of your own product line. You know what you sell. You know what your shipping policies are, you know what your refund policy is, you know all these things, and you know them so deeply and so clearly that you can't even envision not knowing them. So you have to find a way with the help of a consultant or, you know, somebody that has an outside perspective. I had a really interesting conversation with a sign company a few years ago. I was working on a project that involved purchasing a lot of different signage. And in the signage industry, you have different substrates, different materials, different installations. It's complicated. And it's not even just a matter of how much does the sign cost, but there's layers of is this legible in certain conditions, like is it a lit sign? Is it a monument sign? Is it electrical hookup? All kinds of stuff, right? So I'm talking to the sign company that I'm using because I have to call them all the time and ask them questions. And I said, wouldn't it be interesting if your website provided a little more guidance for me? so that when I know I want this type of sign, not that I would even necessarily buy it online, but to educate me that the best sign for this corner for a semi-permanent installation, you know, where there's kind of wind conditions, is probably one of these four types. Here are things you should look at, you know. But I've not to this day encountered a sign company website that did anything like that. They list, you know, their product offerings, if you're lucky, in jargon, you know, in the inside industry words that don't necessarily translate to non-sign people. You know,
that's right.
they don't give you any clues, you know, what you may be looking for. And I know people think that there maybe is potential benefit of making people call you, but there's really not, you know. I would happily, you know, be able to get twice as far with my work or my choices because you've helped me, you know, and then ultimately place an order with you. Forcing me to call you so you can, you know, sell me, you know, or follow up with me, you know, that's not a modern relationship. You know, that's not the kind of relationship I want to have with you as a vendor. I want to give you business, but I want it to work on, you know, my terms and what works for me, not what works for you. And I don't think there's enough of that thought process. I feel like many business owners that I talk to are very close to their business, insider lingo, and think about how they want to do business with customers, not how customers want to do business with them.
That's great advice. And I think, you know, the idea of having essentially all the information that, you know, customers may ask questions of a business, having that easily found on the website is a very powerful tool. Not only does it kind of establish a relationship, it positions you talked about positioning earlier, so it positions that sign company as the authority in their field, and it educates their client, so they're not trying to sell them, they're trying to give them the best solution. And it saves time as well, because the people on the phone answering the questions, they're probably answering the same question day in, day out.
Absolutely.
The same questions day in, day out. So they can, you know, the questions can be answered on the website, positioning the business as an authority, positioning them as being the most helpful, you know, sign company that's on the internet. And then people will phone up when they're ready to buy, so that the whole focus of the time and energy that people taking phone calls there can be spent on actually building the relationships and making the sale and making sure that, you know,
the decision
kind of deliver a good solution.
Exactly. The decision to do business with someone isn't based on, you know, someone like knocking you with a mallet into doing it, you know. Like, we're just gonna hammer you into buying our signs. You know, it's like, bring people to you, you know, give them service. And that idea of be a partner, you know, when you want to think about long-term relationships with anybody, you know, anybody that's in a service type business, it could be a plumber, it could be a roofer, it could be a sign vendor, you know. There are very few things that you only use once in life, and there are very few things that you're not asked for recommendation by, you know, friends or family or other people. So, you know, being of service and being a relationship type vendor is a really, really important thing to think about. And then really, how do you translate that, you know, in a digital world? It can be done. You know, but I don't think it's, you know, being number one on Google or it's just not it.
Yeah. I was just about to go back there and saying it's kind of a big contrast, isn't it? And also, you know, I read all these emails that I tend to get and I say, well, you obviously haven't done any research, because I mean, they're not even speaking to what do you want to rank for, you know?
Right, exactly.
And I mean, maybe I want to rank for websites that dominate the world. You know, I'm never going to rank number one on that. So, they're making a kind of a, it's just a promise straight out there. It's ridiculous. And then, you know, though, for those people that genuinely believe, okay, it's important to get to number one, well, you know, have you thought about the audience that you want to reach? Because, you know, if what happens if you get to number one for, I don't know, clown suits? Does that sell you more signs?
Right, exactly. And it's, you know, the concept, it's like there's no easy button, you know? We learned that a long time ago, right? There's a certain amount of work involved with anything that's actually successful. So when somebody comes to you, if they came to you in another format, right, and said, I can double your investment overnight, or, you know, I can do this, or I can do that, you would immediately say, this doesn't sound likely.
Yeah, if it's too good to be true.
You know, maybe you need to say to yourself, getting a random email from someone, and boy, I mean, does that take you down a bad path? Because at the best case, you're wasting money, but at the worst case, you may be, you know, giving access to your website to, you know, somebody who really, you know, just shouldn't be making those kinds of changes. Or, you know, we saw a lot of those backlink penalty things. And so I think it's a huge, it's just a huge issue. I've seen people, you know, clients wooed away by this, you know, $500 a month and we'll put you number one on Google, or actually we'll just destroy your website for you and move on.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating stuff. So you also said somewhere that, you know, you're talking about project management, and I do have a question in the buzz around this, but I really liked what you said here. And it's like that a lot of the times, and I guess this is true not only of project management that we talk, I mean, maybe SEO is an example of that. We talk about a tool. So, you know, for project management, is it Teamwork or Asana or Trello? But it's actually a process. So until we get the process right, the tool is pretty useless.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I really like that philosophy.
I think that's probably the, you know, as another message that I would like to, you know, really work on this year. It's I see this happen over and over again where there's so many conversations about project management, and the immediate response is, what do you use? I use. What do you use? I use. Yeah. And it, completely irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. You can project manage virtually anything with any kind of tool, and it's really a matter of looking at your, you know, are you looking at this? Is it a business process, you know, that you're focusing on, you know, because there's a lot of different models, right? You might be a web development agency, or you might be a kind of a, you know, new media company, right? That's creating training courses and different things, which is a completely different, potentially, series of steps and tasks. But they all are going to have themes in common. And from a project management perspective, I would be more inclined to look at things like what are the volume of tasks that you're managing over what period of time, what type of resources are involved? Are they all, you know, is it a small team that's all internal to a company? Is it a diverse team of like core and contractors type models? So you really need to start, you know, at the beginning and think about, also, is this a one-off? I need to, you know, start a company, say. That's a project. But that company is only starting for a certain period of time. You know, at some point you move from starting to a sustainable operation. And it's operations management at that point. It's not finding real estate. It's not, you know, wiring up, you know, internet and networking anymore. So there's, you know, you really need to think about what are you trying to accomplish? What kind of systems do you want to put in place, short term, long term? They're finding a tool that's going to work well for you and the team as a whole. But I really think we overemphasize the tools. I think you could, you know, get to a good result with almost any tool that's out there today. Some might be more enjoyable than others, but that is not the key thing to focus on.
Hmm. And also, if you get the process the way it works for you, and I'm trying to avoid using the word right because there's no right way. It's a process that will work for certain situations or certain people or certain teams. Then once you have a certain process, then there might be a tool that is better suited to that process than
exactly.
another tool. So it's kind of, you know, a lot of people choose the tool and then kind of try and figure out a process rather
right.
than the other way around.
And I think it's really important to document and work through your processes independently of tools, because you may change tools at some point. Tools might go away, but if your intention is to be a sustainable organization, no matter what size, there really should be documents. Even if it's a one person undertaking, how much easier is it to pull up your checklist that you use for example, like this podcast, that there's a series of steps you go through, you know, religiously. You don't rethink them every time. You know what, you know, you've done it for a while. You know what the best way to do it is, you know, what's most efficient, and you write that down, you know, and then you follow that process. And once you make things efficient and repeatable and you have them captured somewhere, and the beauty of capturing them, I think, is, I mean, I only have so many brain cells to go around, you know? It's like, how much easier yeah. is it for me to just, you know, pick up a list I did and say, oh, yeah, Diane, follow this list, you know, than, oh, how, wait, what did I don't remember exactly, you know, what I did to do this. But the other beauty of that is that can be shared, you know. So it can be shared with a partner. It can be shared with a VA. It can be shared with a contractor. It just is one of the things that, as a, you know, a sign of a business that is getting mature and sustainable, are systems and processes, I think.
Okay, So that there, that little recommendation there was worth just listening to this entire podcast on its own. So thank you for doing that. That's excellent. And I do have a very well documented process for the podcast, as well as some other things. We're still working on a few, but yeah, you're right. One of the things I like to say, and you know, you were talking earlier about being an artist and being creative and liking to build things, you know, that requires some thought and brain cells, as you put it. So if those brain cells are cluttered up with having to remember how to do repetitive tasks and repetitive processes, then you're not going to have them available for, you know, being creative and making things. So
absolutely,
yeah, makes things a lot more fun as well. And like you say, it can be given to other people. So yeah, that's just great advice. All right. So in terms of, you know, the versatility group, is there, like, what are the biggest challenges you face within your own business internally?
I think the classic challenge is probably content on projects. And it's not even, this is a topic that fascinates me, because I wonder if we'll, you know, actually ever get to a solution. You know, I'm starting to think maybe not, you know. because I've been doing this for a while, and it's been an interesting arc. In the beginning, of course, with those early websites, a lot of them were fairly light on content, you know, and now as media has become richer, content's deeper, if you want to be optimized for search engines, you know, there's some thought process on that. And I think the single most challenging thing I think it's more prevalent on small and medium-sized projects, possibly, than larger projects. Larger projects have different challenges. But I still think it's very, very hard for customers, even when told, content is a lot of work. It's going to take you a considerable amount of time to pull your content together. And there's solutions, right? A lot of times you'll hear people say, well, if you hired a copywriter, well, a copywriter doesn't necessarily know anything about the business.
That's right.
And can't help shape at least that, you know, that initial. So this is one of the things that I think is I'm building more and more time into projects for kind of content consulting, because I always have conversations where people are like, no problem. That is not a problem. I mean, because a few years ago, became very straightforward about this. We can, yes, do this project in X time, but you will not have your content done in that time. Mm-hmm. Oh, we will. No, you won't. I know you believe you will, but you won't. Because you've got a business to run and you've already got a full-time job.
Yeah, that's right.
And it is not realistic, and it sounds simpler than it is. So I would like to figure out some new ideas in this area. I hear the same thing, and you know, I've been guilty in the past of saying the same thing over and over, like you know, you need to get all the content before the project starts. I don't think that is necessarily valid. You need some amount of content before the project starts, hopefully, because you need some baselines. But I'm a big believer in designing content. So if I don't know what your content is, or you dump it all into an empty shell of a website that I've already built, or, you know, a lot of the models that we use today aren't great. They're not great. And I'm working on just trying, experimenting with, you know, keeping things a little bit looser, getting some content in, doing some design in the browser so people can see the potential, you know, of what could be. And, you know, there's probably more content work that needs to come after that. And so this is probably my biggest area of challenge and interest, is how can you cost effectively, without driving yourself crazy, do the best, you know, possible job in, you know, supporting clients with their content.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I just kept nodding while you were saying that, because that's definitely my experience as well. You know, content is always the thing that holds up the website build, and like you say, clients will say, oh, yeah, you know, if you can do the website in 4 or 6 weeks, we'll have the content ready for you.
Right.
Hang on, there's about 15, 20 pages of stuff here. So yeah, I've been doing experiments around that too, and like you, I haven't really come across a solution yet. What we're doing at the moment, and with mixed results, is we very early on in a website project, we run content sessions, so content strategy sessions, and I'm trying to refine the questions I ask. So essentially, I've got probably 2 hours worth of questions, and I interview the client or the clients and record that. and then we kind of cut and mix and match. So my thinking there is that, you know, and one of the downsides of using a copywriter is that even if they capture or if they understand the business, if they take the time to understand the business, and then, you know, it sounds, what they're writing sounds like they know the business as well, they don't, you know, they don't really capture the voice of that business, or, you know, the business owner, or, you know, they don't capture their character. And I think, you know, the website, it should be really a reflection of the culture and the character and the personality of that business.
Very much so. And I think the other challenge is that the copywriter kind of answer doesn't solve is, as you elicit ideas around content, there are a lot of different forms, even visually, content can take, you know? So grid or cards versus text on a page versus, you know, lists or different things. So one of the challenges I find interesting is, even if they have something today, right, once you really have a conversation with them, you know, maybe there's a library of specialized white papers that's part of this organization, and they've just been PDF links on the website. We have to take a step back and think about, is that really, really, you know, what we should be doing with this? Is that the best way to surface this content? Is, you know, is that findable, discoverable? Does it tell people enough about what it's about? You know, so, and that's just like one small example potentially. So
that's right. Yeah.
I think that is the big, when, you know, you kind of are in this situation where, people are investing money with you to give them the best possible product. At least that's really important to me, you know, for, you know, whatever that project is, I'd like to do the best job for them possible. And so far, you know, there isn't a process around content and all those questions and kind of the iterative nature of it that lets you quickly and cost effectively, you know, do great content work. And I don't think clients really focus that much on great content work because they don't know what the potential is.
Yeah.
So their question is, can you have a new website for us in 6 weeks? And yes, conceptually, maybe, if you can get your content together. But even that type of thinking doesn't necessarily account for potential, what really could be, if you were looking for maybe best outcome and not fastest. So I think that's just a very interesting entire, you know, topic to see what we can do and innovate in that space, and ease a lot of the pain today on both sides. You know, the web shops of the world are like, oh, content, and the clients are like, oh, my web developer, you know. It's like, but this friction exists, you know, kind of for a reason that's, you know, neither party's exact fault. You know, it's a kind of a process and innovation problem.
That's right. Well, that's a fascinating discussion, and I'm sure it's something that I'd love to follow up with you at some point. But I'm looking at the clock here, and I think, you know, I've really enjoyed this discussion, but I think it's time we moved on to the buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience who are innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got 5 questions that I'm going to ask, and hopefully we'll get some really insightful answers from you that'll inspire people to go away and do something awesome as a result. So, first one, what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Systems and processes. So you can move your brain from repetitive, busy work to innovation.
I love it. Yes, that's great advice. Okay, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas or new products?
Get away from my desk.
Mm-hmm.
Shower, walk, sit by the lake. The best ideas come to you when you're not seeking them. I've tried many times to, think of something, and it's just really moving away from your work environment makes you far more creative.
Hmm. So giving yourself space, if you like.
Definitely.
Hmm. All right. Now, here's a tool question. What's your favorite tool or system for improving productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
Probably my phone. In the last, I have a larger phone now. And I can do so much on my phone. I can dictate right into Google Docs. I can use project management tools. I can do a lot of that work that's necessary, but not super valuable, and just kind of knock it out, in between different things. And I think that has been one of the really, really cool things for me in the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's great. Great advice. And actually, that reminds me, I discovered this app for Android, which is a dictation app, that the accuracy of that is absolutely fabulous. And I can do it because I speak German as well. So I can switch languages on that, and it's about 99% accurate in both languages. So I've started using the phone more and more, like you say, as a tool to do some of these things that normally I'd get back on the computer on the keyboard for.
Exactly. I found that, I don't know exactly why, but when I dictate into a Google Doc, if you install Google Docs on your phone and use the microphone, it's just very straightforward dictation, and it's really, really accurate. And I don't know why it's more accurate than other things I've tried, because I've tried a lot of different things, but it's very accurate. And I've done a fair amount of that with the book, where I could just, kind of talk to my phone and then go back and work on that text and work on that copy later, which is very helpful.
Hmm. Okay, so phone as a favorite tool, that's great. What's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
Keep yourself on track. I think, I really believe that it really starts with you. We have a little bit of a culture where sometimes there's some abdication of personal responsibility. The project is off track. Well, a project's not a lie,
Yeah.
And the client's not in charge. So if things are off track, it honestly is because you let them get off track. And I know that sounds kind of harsh, but it's really the truth. And you've got to hold yourself accountable for how you do things. And so really for me, if something goes off track, which things do all the time, it's really a matter of looking at the situation and not beating yourself up, but saying, what could I do differently to be more proactive about this? And that might be in your proposals, your contracts, your day-to-day communication, how you onboard people, how you set expectations. But the single biggest way to keep improving is to be really honest with yourself, and not, blame the client or, abstract entity. Oh, this project is driving me crazy. Yeah. It's like, the project's not a sentient being.
Yeah, that's great advice. So, so there's a chap here on the speaking circuit in Australia who I follow. His name's Tom O'Toole, and he says, whenever there's a problem in my business, all I have to do is look in the mirror.
Exactly.
So great advice. So finally, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Find a way to add value. if you can, and value can mean different things in different industries and to different people, but if you give more than you take, and I think that that applies in many, many different ways. So let's say you are on a project and the project has a price and it has a very defined scope. You know, I'm not suggesting that you allow, you know, scope creep or unmanaged changes, but if you can give more than you take, a little bit more than you got paid for, if you can share your knowledge with peers, if you can speak, you can teach. I just believe that a culture of giving in every area will reward you handsomely in the long run. If you take an attitude that's very, you know, nitpicky and what have you done for me lately, and I'm not going to help you if you don't, you know, help me, and I think take an attitude of giving and always, you know, try to leave a situation better, you know, better than you started.
Yeah, that's great advice, and I love the whole, you know, I mean, it's a whole cultural thing that pervades, you know, the individual and the organization they're in. So it's a case of really, you know, being of service and having a service.
Exactly.
Mentality.
Of service is the perfect phrase.
All right. So what's the future for you then and for Validity Coaching?
Well, it's going to be an interesting year. We're finishing the book. I've got a couple big projects on deck for Versatility this year that I'm excited about. And I'm working on a not website company undertaking, kind of getting back to some of my art roots perhaps, and launching maybe something new. Early days, but I'm very excited about doing something tangible products. So we'll see what happens there.
We'll keep a lookout for that then. Yeah. All right. So, what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in their field and a leader in innovation?
Be generous. Be generous, because if you will help other people and be of service, as you said, other people will help you. They will share their ideas. They'll share their techniques. They'll support you when you need support. And being supported, well-networked, well thought of individual will allow you to be your best self.
That's great advice. Yeah. So helping others, and again, there's that philosophy of a servant's heart or servant's mentality, I call it. Yeah. So thank you, Diane. This has been really great. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned a lot, and I always love these podcasts because I say it's like a masterclass for me. So where can people reach out and say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
You can always find me on Twitter, D. Kinney. Our company website's the Versatility Group. I've got a personal site at dianekinney.com that I'm working on. You can drop me a note there if you like. So I'm very findable.
Okay, and we'll have links to all of those in the show notes as well. So finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
I would like you to interview Brian Krogsgaard, who is the publisher of something called PostStatus, which is a news and community that he's built around the WordPress space. And I think it's very innovative. And it's been very successful. So the idea that you could, you know, build a business around a super, super, you know, niche product, really like WordPress, and make that into a successful business, I think is fascinating. And Brian is a really smart guy, so you'll like him a lot.
Yeah, I've listened to some of his podcasts, so he is really good. So Brian, look out for an invitation from us for the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Diane Kinney. So thanks so much, Diane, for sharing your time and your insights with us on the podcast today so generously. I've really enjoyed this, and I wish you all the best for the future of the Versatility Group, for the launch of the Real World Freelancing book, and also for that other new initiative that you hinted at. So all the best for that, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed meeting Diane as much as I enjoyed this interview with her, and that you learned something new or have been reminded of something that you might have put on the not important pile. All the show notes for this episode will be at innovabiz.com.au/Diane Kinney. That is DianeKinney. All lowercase, all one word, Diane with one N and Kinney with two N's. innovabiz.com.au/Diane Kinney. Diane suggested I interview Brian Krogsgaard, who is the publisher of Post Status, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. So Brian, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from me to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Diane Kinney. Thank you to my audience for listening. Pop on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe so you'll never miss a future episode. While you're there, you might leave us a review, because not only do reviews help us get found and your feedback helps us to improve, but it also helps to share this information with a bigger audience. And I think it's really worth doing with wonderful interviews like we've had today. If there's anything you'd like us to cover or questions you want answered on a future Innova Buzz podcast, please send them to us. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from Innova Biz. Remember, if you don't innovate, you stagnate. So think big, be adventurous, and keep innovating.